We are getting creepy and curious on you this morning. Well, it is a creepy and curious world out there, and I think we're tipping into the curious end of the scale this morning. If you are in the middle of morning tea, don't worry, we're not going to affect your ability to digest. But Dr. Kirsty Abbott is joining us for the first time in 2015, and she's this year the coordinator of the School of Ants, and it's an insect ecology lab at the University of New England, and she's going to be doing a bit of travelling as well this year. But good morning to you, Kirsty.
Good morning, Kelly.
Thanks for joining us in the studio. You've been posting photos of yourself doing handstands recently.
Well, it is handstand February.
It is. Is it? I hadn't caught
every
that
year.
One.
Yeah. Yep.
You're very good at handstands.
Well, I have been a gymnast pretty much all my life, so it's a good opportunity, I think, to just revisit my handstanding. I do like handstands. It's really, really good for you, apparently.
Oh, why?
Inversions, generally, I think yoga people would know this as well. Inversions shake up your digestive system a little bit, and also handstands use, they get the blood running to your brain, they use upper body strength, it's really good for balance, all sorts of stuff.
Gee, I wonder, could you do an entire Creepy But Curious in a handstand mode?
Oh, so look, you've set me a challenge already.
That would be fascinating. Look, we'll move on past the handstands, but we do have tons to talk about. You and I've been watching you put together, I guess, this insect ecology lab for a little while now. What's it all about?
Well, I'm part of Nigel Andrews Insect Ecology Lab and run this National Citizen Science project in the lab called School of Ants. Unlike School for Ants, which is in Zoolander, which I think a lot of people think of when they hear School of Ants. So School of Ants is really an Australian version or offshoot of a US project that started about 4 years ago, investigating the diversity and distribution of ants around a particular nation. And I'm doing Australia. So citizen science, collecting information about ants around Australia, allows me to get a massive data set around a country, broad geographic scales, very powerful data set to analyse. So big spatial area and continue it over time that one researcher or two researchers just can't do at all. So the project's been running since May last year, but this year we're taking it on tour. So I'm packing up the family and we're going to rural and remote Australia, but all over the place really, basing educational days around this School of Ants idea, looking at diversity and distribution of ants around in towns and cities, and also what foods they like to eat. So I'm really looking forward to finding out more about ants around the country and getting citizens, really, as scientists, to help me do it.
Wow. So you're literally packing up your family and jumping in a caravan and taking a year to do this?
Yes, literally. We're packing up right now boxes and pulling things off the wall and things like that, talking about first aid kits and satellite phones and...
Oh my gosh. And so how do you hope people contribute, or how do you want people to be a part of it?
Oh, anybody can do this from preschool kind of to retirement villages, which I love the idea of. And so we have a website, schoolofants.net.au, and there's a registration page. You can register to just do a one-off collection. And really it's just putting five pieces of cardboard in a concrete area, five pieces of cardboard in a grass area with some food baits on it. You wait an hour and count the number of ants that are on each food type, collect them up and send them to me. Or you can register for our year-long project, which means you just do that every month until November.
And you don't collect the ants up, you just collect
you collect the food the ants that are on the food card that after an hour. So you stick them in a Ziploc bag and
send them off to you.
Yeah.
Gee.
So we can tell you what species you've got in your schoolyard or your backyard or your local park or something like that.
And what if you get a bit of a scary one?
Warning. Yeah. Well, in fact, that is one of the benefits of the program. It essentially provides a passive surveillance program to detect invasive species where they might not be looking.
How amazing.
Mm.
Wow. Okay. Well, Kirsty Abbott's with us on ABC New England Northwest. You might like to get on board with this project even across the New England and Northwest and put out your baits. We'll put a link on our Facebook page, if that's okay, Kirsty, if people are going to be looking for it. So, but if the people are not on Facebook, how would you get involved?
Well, it'll be through the University of New England, and also really literally going to schoolofants.net.au. So if anybody just types in School of Ants into the Google machine, it will appear.
Great. All right. Well, we're going to follow you along the road, if that's okay, throughout the year and see how it's all going.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, I'm hoping that I can update and do creepy but curious stories from the road, because I'm sure I'll be coming across a lot being the ant lady around Australia.
That'll be exciting. So on the School of Ants caravan, we'll follow Kirsty on this, virtually we'll follow her on this tour. But let's talk a bit more about ants. Recently, you've been looking at some interesting information about what happens to ants if they are kept away from their colony or if they're kept in isolation.
Yeah. And in fact, if anybody follows ABC Science or Science Alert, they would have seen some headlines that editors have been choosing all over the country lately called "Lonely Ants Die Young and Hungry." And
it's so sad.
It is. And look, those sorts of emotive words in science, partly, I think, are quite useful because it attracts people that wouldn't normally read things about this, like this, about social organisms and ecology, and to do it. And also, using words like lonely and isolation means that you're kind of anthropomorphising it a little bit, and people start to emotionally connect to that. And I think that's really important, actually, because ants may be lonely. I'm as so truly social insects, if they were kept in isolation, I imagine like they would have their own form of loneliness.
Gee. So in these instances, they were purposefully separated to see what impact it would have on them?
There was a lab in France that was following some very old research, taking ants away from their colony. And look, ants are truly social organisms. So really, we view ants really, the level of individual is as the colony. You could call them super organisms, if you like. And so they really act as an individual based on thousands of individual ants in the colony. They're constantly transferring information. They're sharing food continually. They're reading chemical trails and communicating continually. So a lot of people have been interested in what happens when you take organisms like this away from that continual interaction. And in ants, in the past, in the 1920s and the 1940s, there was a little bit of research on honeybees and ants, saying that when you take ants away from a colony, they die early. So these people in France just recently followed that up. And what they did was they placed some ants by themselves. So they had lots of replicates, 29, 30 replicates of ants by themselves. They had lots of replicates of ants in pairs. They had ants in groups of 10, and then they had ants with a colony. And they looked at the longevity of the workers, and they also looked at how they were sharing food and how they used food. And so with all these ants, they fed them all, and then they kept them hungry as well. And the interesting thing they found, and this was highly significant results, the ants by themselves only lived for 6 days.
Oh.
Yeah. but this was in only when they were fed. So when there's food going throughout the colony and these ants had access to food, the ants in isolation lived for 6 days. The ants in groups of 10 and with the colony lived for over 60 days. So that's a really significant difference. But what they found was when they took the food away from all the colonies, there was actually no difference at all. And they went, oh, that's really weird. So maybe this isolation, loneliness, dying early has something to do with food and with energy transfer or something like that, or digestibility of food or something like that. And so for me, the interesting part is that food plays an incredibly important part in our social interactions. And we know this from social mammals and vertebrates as well as social insects. The sharing of food, pollen in honeybee colonies, but the sharing of food in ants is continual, 24/7 basically. Ants collect food from out and about. They find some honeydew or some dead things, and they actually only collect liquid. Ants only eat liquid food. They bring it back to the nest, and through a process called trophallaxis, which really just means sharing food, they're constantly moving this food and energy throughout the colony, feeding larvae and each other and the queen and this food. So when this food's available, ants in isolation still eat the food, but they don't have anyone to share it with. So they actually don't digest it. It just stays in this storage crop that they have. So they're eating away. There's nobody to share it with. So they just shut down their digestive processes. And in the meantime, they become incredibly hyperactive.
Really?
Yeah. So the behavioural changes that these researchers found was significant as well. The isolated ants went berserk running around their little chambers. I would like to think looking for somebody to share their food with and have a good meal.
Or a way out.
Or a way out, yeah. A way out to find some conspecifics or find some of their sisters to share their food with. So what they did was run around a lot so that they used up a heap of energy, but they weren't digesting their food. So they weren't replacing that energy at all. Yet in all the other treatments where they had friends, sisters, colony members, the sharing of that food actually maintained the energy balance between the ants. They were interacting continually and it allowed them to live longer. Wow. And share a good meal.
Dr. Kirsty Abbott with us on ABC New England Northwest, creepy but curious and the fascinating life of ants. So what does this all mean, Kirsty, about ants and what can we take away from that information?
Well, for me, obsessed with social insects and ants in general. I think looking at social organisms, whether they be vertebrates or invertebrates, we know that social isolation affects people. And when I'm talking people, I'm talking humans here as well, psychologically, behaviourally, and also gastrointestinally. So actually we know that humans that have behavioural deficits and sometimes on the autism spectrum or that people have been in isolation, they don't digest their food as well. They don't digest their food as efficiently. And also they don't get as much energy from their food. So, and we know actually, and the ant research supports a lot of the research in mammalogy research, that social isolation leads to behavioural problems, depression, cardiovascular disease, and in fact increased disease from up as close as a week in isolation, and obviously longer. These things that get worse. So you die earlier, you get more diseases, and you're more likely to have behavioural and mental illnesses, essentially.
Are you surprised to see that reflected in the life of ants, you know, what we see in humans? Are you surprised to find that?
Not really. My research has actually been in an area of yellow crazy ants on Christmas Island in super colonies where the density of ants is some of the highest in the world. So there were so many ants interacting at such an incredibly high rate and sharing food at an incredibly high rate that I can imagine if you're used to living with all these people with such continual interaction, information transfer, and social interaction, isolating yourself from that would initially just be a bit of a culture shock, quite frankly, even for ants, and they wouldn't really know what to do. I think without having that input of information of what you're doing, particularly for social organisms like ants that are altruistic and really kind of live for the colony, if you like, without having that input and knowing what's going on with the queen, with their sisters, and within the colony itself, then they've kind of got nothing to do, no direction, no guidance or anything like that. So when I saw this research come out now, I was kind of like, that's not surprising, but I think what they're finding is the mechanism whereby it happens is the interesting part. So it's probably got much more to do with the food and the food sharing than we initially imagined.
And, I mean, we've well and truly anthropomorphized, I can't say, the ants this morning. Is it good to do that, so that we become more aware of what they...
Look, I think this is a bit controversial, really. I think I could... upset people as a scientist. I really like and value and respect objective and accurate information. So in this respect, really these results are only relevant to ants. And if you're being specific, then we're just talking social organisms, social insects here for this research specifically. But as a science communicator, it is incredibly important to be able to get people who don't do science or who aren't familiar with all these details to be able to relate to it somehow. And so actually anthropomorphising, good look at us both, a lot of these issues can actually really just be a trigger for engaging people in science. And so I think in that respect, it's interesting. And also it's all perspective, right? You know, somebody might call an ant lonely, and another person might call an ant adventurous and independent, going out on its own. So, you know, using language like that can change your perspective on these things enormously, which is why as scientists we use data and objective language as possible.
I always, but yeah, because I always wonder when there's that lone ant running across the kitchen counter, is he lost or is he the search party that, or is he on the hunt?
I never know. Exactly.
They won't answer, so I don't know which way to go. But
well,
so,
it's she. To, it's she. Cal,
it's
she.
Always a
yep.
she, isn't
yep.
it? Okay. I'm wondering, what's the one question that you are yet to find an answer for when it comes to ants? Is there anything in particular that you are really hungry to find out?
Oh, that's such a good question. Every scientist I know has about 100. My burning one at the moment, which I'm interested in looking at around Australia as well, but of course probably won't have time, is I work on mutualisms between ants and honeydew-producing insects. A lot of my research has been that, and how that mutualism fuels this explosion of invasive ants particularly. But honeydew is literally just this sugar source, a food resource for ants. And this research on the isolation of ants has been interesting because it says if you're getting a sugar source from honeydew like that, then you can fuel this really, really high levels of activities like yellow crazy ants on Christmas Island. But I want to know why some ants farm honeydew-producing scale insects and aphids and bugs and things like that and don't explode in numbers if you've got this enormous sugar honeydew supply and carbohydrates in excess. Why are some of them just ticking along? And so I'm interested in the dynamic between invasive ants and honeydew producers and why that causes explosions in invasive and bad ants versus these insects that have co-evolved with their sugar source, and they obviously regulate it to the point where they don't explode in numbers and go completely berserk and have an impact on the environment. So, you know, that's one of my big ones.